suffering from such visible skin disorders. Even the most kind-hearted among us appear to associate acne sufferers with undesirable characteristics. At least these were the results reported by the psychologist Tracy Granfeld and her colleagues in the Journal of Health Psychology. Using a variation of the implicit association test, an empirical measure used to get at people's unconscious attitudes and beliefs, the authors found that compared with our ratings of clear-skinned individuals, we're quick to associate unpleasant concepts such as brutal, bad, ugly, angry, aggressive, vomit, and mean with acne sufferers. These authors reasoned that this unfair, unconscious, and visceral reaction to those with serious acne also betrays our evolutionary origins. Research indicates that significant disruptions of the skin surface, showing blood, pus, or flaking skin, elicit greater disgust and contamination fears among observers than cleaner disruptions, such as vitiligo and port wine stains. For many people, especially those who score high on the personality dimension of social sensitivity, acne is not simply a nuisance. Rather, it can seep ruinously into the individual's core self-concept and lead to severe mental health problems, even rivaling the distress associated with facial disfigurement from burns or accidents. 1/3 of New Zealand teenagers who describe themselves as having problem acne had thoughts of suicide. 1/4 displayed clinically significant levels of depression, and 1/10 had high levels of anxiety. As long ago as 1948, the clinicians Marion Sulzberger and Sadie Zaidens concluded that it is our considered opinion that there is no single disease that causes more psychic trauma, more maladjustments between parents and children, more general insecurity and feelings of inferiority, and greater sums of psychic suffering than does acne vulgaris. That was more than 60 years ago, and of course the acne treatment industry has grown enormously since then. So has the psychiatric subfield of psychodermatology. Although not always without its own unpleasant side effects, there is an ever-flourishing pharmaceutical garden of ointments, creams, and pills today that the acne sufferers of pus-filled yore could only dream about. Still, not all such treatments are equally available to those with acne. There are considerable individual differences in response to drugs, and a fail-safe cure remains elusive. In fact, I suspect that by contrast to previous generations, those who experience moderate to severe acne today find themselves even more depressed than those who came before. Just as overweight people who have tried every diet without success often report feeling powerless over their condition, anyone who has attempted unsuccessfully to rid himself of acne with a wide range of treatment options may feel even more ashamed than ever. It's little solace to these poor souls that the condition, like most other human traits, is determined by some combination of genes and environment. How exactly our DNA interacts with diet, face washing habits, exposure to the sun, or any other factor remains little understood. Yet, just as some members of that commiserating breed, the Mexican hairless dog, are more prone to acne than others, so too are some of us hairless apes. In balance, acne seems to have less to do with how we live than with whose family we were born into. Intriguingly, and for reasons that are still unclear, certain human populations, such as the Kitavan Islanders of Papua New Guinea and the Ake of Paraguay, are spared the blackhead plague. Although their diets and lifestyles are very different from our own, so are their genes. Yes, less is more in the present case, but few of us are so lucky as to have the silken pelage of a Wookiee or find ourselves born an indigenous Kitavan Islander, and the lifelong zitless are extremely rare. The best-case scenario is that your skin isn't too much of a workaholic when it comes to sebum production, and so like everyone else, you'll get the occasional breakout here and there. Ideally, in terms of your psychological health, the pimples will be hidden somewhere over there rather than here on that blinking marquee that is your face, unprotected from the elements. Whether your acne disappears by your teens or not until your 40s, your sebaceous glands will one day, I promise you, run dry as an ancient riverbed. Although you could have easily gotten lost in her glorious wrinkles, for example, I don't remember a single zit on my 89-year-old grandmother's face when that non-ethereal soul of hers was peaceably rehydrated by formaldehyde. So remember, all of you with reddened hides in hiding, those in sore oozing discontent, acne is a passing cosmetic calamity. There's no shame in shame, so ask for help if you need it. You aren't alone in your distress. But save some worrying for the slowly gestating, well-earned wrinkles to come. Above all, be kind to your inner ape that lost its fur in haste. Part 3. Minds in the Gutter. Naughty by nature, when brain damage makes people very, very randy. If you're listening to this, my guess is that you're a materialist holding the logical belief that the human brain, with all of its buzzing neural intricacies, its pulpy, electrified arabesque chambers and labyrinthine coves, has been carved out over countless eons by the slow and steady hand of natural selection. You will grant, then, that specific brain regions evolved because they generated behaviors that were beneficial to our ancestors. When one part of the brain is compromised through injury, disease, or some other unfortunate event, the constellation of symptoms that result are often remarkably specific. The brain is the physical manifestation of the personality and sense of self, writes the neuroscientist Shelley Batts in Behavioral Sciences in the Law, and focal damage to brain areas can result in focal changes in behavior and personality while leaving other aspects of the self unchanged. Not to get too technical, but if you're unlucky enough to develop a lesion that interferes with the functioning of your dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, a specialized patch of neurotissue that's intricately braided into your anterior cingulate cortex, then your working memory and strategy formation and planning skills are going to take a major nosedive. And suddenly, something as simple as coming up with a list of groceries becomes a major achievement. Most of us have sympathy aplenty for those patients whose brain disturbances have interfered with their everyday cognitive abilities. We're perfectly willing to accommodate their intellectual disabilities by helping them create a new mnemonic strategy or giving them a pat on the back or a word of encouragement when they're trying to remember someone's name. Because frankly, who hasn't struggled with these things? Yet when chunks of gray matter that have evolved to control and inhibit, say, our sexual appetites and other bacchanalian drives experience a similar catastrophic blowout, are we so understanding? What if these impairments lead the victims to display, I don't know, let's call them moral disabilities? Cases of libidinal brain systems going haywire have our kind-hearted humanistic materialism rubbing elbows or butting heads with our belief in free will and moral culpability. Although Kluver-Busey syndrome is relatively rare, it's one of the most notorious neurological causes of a complete breakdown in one's ability to control sexual urges. In 1939, the neuroanatomists Heinrich Kluver and Paul Busey removed the greater portions of both temporal lobes and the rhynencephalon from the brains of rhesus monkeys. Initially, these scientists were interested in studying how mescaline administration produced seizures similar to temporal lobe fits in epileptic patients, and so were attempting to isolate the effects of those drug-addled brain regions. Among a host of other peculiar effects of this rather cruel vivisection, however, the monkeys became incredibly randy, displaying a prominent and indiscriminate desire to copulate. The first documented case of full-blown Kluver-Busey in humans arrived in 1955, when an epilepsy patient underwent a bilateral temporal lobectomy, a surgical excision of the lobes, and subsequently developed a ravenous sexual appetite, among other things. More often, the syndrome appears in lesser degrees, precipitated by a nasty insult to the medial temporal lobe. It might result from a case of herpes encephalitis or Pick's disease, or from trauma and oxygen deprivation. Not all such patients experience hypersexuality, mind you, but some do. Other symptoms aren't terribly appealing either, however. They include hyperorality, a compulsive desire to put things in one's mouth, apathy, emotional unresponsiveness, and various sensory disorders. Dramatic case studies illustrating the devastating effects of Kluver-Busey syndrome abound in the clinical literature, and they raise intriguing philosophical questions for us to consider with respect to the sheer physicality of free will. That some patients so stricken are overcome with excessive carnal urges and are not simply using the disorder as a convenient excuse to become freely promiscuous, lewd, and lascivious is perhaps best demonstrated by a 1998 study by the neurologist Sunil Pradhan and his colleagues. In this report, a group of boys between the ages of 2.5 and 6 began to exhibit hypersexualized behaviors after partially recovering from comas induced by herpes encephalitis. 1 to 3 months after emerging from the comatose state, all 7 children, note the authors, demonstrated abnormal sexual behavior in the form of rhythmic hip movements, such as sexual thrusting, rubbing their genitals over the bed, and excessive manipulation of their genitals. Were these children just helpless, hapless puppets of their ancient pleasure-driven brains? The authors believe so. As all patients, they write, were extremely young, with no possibility of environmental learning of sex, these movements most probably represented phylogenetically primitive reflex activities. It may be awkward enough telling other parents why your preschooler is humping everything in sight, just try rehashing the foregoing description of Kluver-Busey syndrome to your friends at the daycare center, but we do tend as adults to be mostly forgiving of a child's improprieties. When this sort of hypersexuality strikes a post-pubescent individual whose sexuality is driven by orgasm-propelled desires, things become more interesting, at least again in a philosophical sense. Although it would be entirely inaccurate to portray Kluver-Busey patients as sex-crazed lunatics, they very often display behaviors that would be considered inappropriate by conventional standards. One gentleman in his early 70s, for instance, hugged a female parishioner at his church and repeatedly kissed her. According to the clinical case report, he then asked the shock woman, "Why don't we do it again?" Over the ensuing years, his sexual fantasy skyrocketed, and his hyperorality became unmanageable. The report notes that, according to his wife, He would put any object in his mouth, including dog food, candles, adhesive bandages, and his wedding ring. His appetite seemed insatiable. He died at age 77 years of asphyxiation on several adhesive bandages. In a letter to the editor of European Psychiatry, two physicians described the case of a 14-year-old schoolgirl, Miss A, who, prior to developing Kluver-Busey syndrome after being in an encephalitis-caused coma, was an intelligent and social girl with a good academic record. This quiet, well-behaved teenager became somewhat challenging, to say the least, after recovering from her illness. You think you're raising a difficult teen? Consider what these parents were dealing with. The doctors write, the patient started disrobing in front of others, manipulating her genitals, and making sexual advances toward her father. She would lick any object lying on the ground, and whenever she got an opportunity, she would rush to the toilet and try to put urine and feces into her mouth, what we'd call urophagia and coprophagia, respectively. In another case, an epileptic woman underwent an unsuccessful left temporal lobectomy to help stop debilitating seizures. Kluver-Busey symptoms, including hypersexuality, emerged following the surgery. She began masturbating in public and aggressively soliciting her family members and neighbors for sex. After having another seizure, she was brought to the emergency room, where after half an hour in the waiting area, she began performing fellatio on an elderly cardiac patient. This may or may not be one of the few examples where one patient's syndrome is another's lucky day. It's also unclear if this was a display of hypersexuality or hyperorality, but it's inevitable, perhaps, that the twain should occasionally meet. Other temporal lobe epileptics have also exhibited hypersexuality in the post-ictal state, which is the period of recovery time following a seizure. The neurologist Vanessa Ornato and her colleagues presented a case of a 39-year-old man who began having semi-frequent seizures during the middle of the night. After nocturnal convulsions, he'd sleep for another 10 minutes, wake up, and then rape his wife. In the author's more delicate wording, he was described as, quote, becoming sexually aggressive toward his wife by forcing intercourse. Importantly, however, we learn the tremendous remorse and abhorrence for what he had done when he learned of his actions led him to pursue possible surgery mainly to eliminate this post-ictal behavior. Other people with similar epileptic profiles also become hypersexualized in the post-ictal state. To his later horror, one man motioned for his 12-year-old daughter to join him and his wife in the bedroom following a nighttime seizure. It is in these last few examples where Kluver-Busey syndrome manifests itself in criminal behavior such as rape or child molestation that our materialistic convictions are really put to the test. In 2003, the neurologists Jeffrey Burns and Russell Swerdlow described how an otherwise well-behaved 40-year-old man developed a case of what they called new-onset pedophilia after suffering the appearance of a right orbitofrontal tumor. The man denied any pre-existing interest in children, but he did have a predilection for pornography before the tumor. Now, however, he was downloading child porn and making subtle sexual advances to his prepubescent stepdaughter. His hypersexuality applied to full-grown women, too. So much so, in fact, that he couldn't keep himself from fondling female nurses and staff during a neurological examination. Long story short, when the man's tumor was removed, his prurient interest and behaviors all but disappeared. And since he was no longer deemed a threat to his stepdaughter, he returned home. But his headaches returned, his tumor regrew, and so did the criminal impulse. A re-resection of the tumor was accomplished, the man became a good citizen again, and as far as we know, that remains true today. In a more recent case co-published by the famed neuroscientist Oliver Sacks, a 51-year-old without any criminal history had part of his right temporal lobe removed to prevent seizures. Following this, he developed telltale signs of Kluver-Busey, including hypersexuality. His was another case of new-onset pedophilia, but as Sacks laments, in spite of this, he was nevertheless sentenced to several years in prison for downloading child porn. What's the takeaway message? I'll let you do the hard work of thinking through the implications for our belief in free will and how it might or might not apply to Kluver-Busey syndrome. But another intriguing question emerges too. If an otherwise good person's brain can be rendered suddenly morally disabled by an invasive tumor or an epileptic short circuit, subsequently causing him or her to do very bad deeds, then isn't it rather hypocritical to assume that a bad person without brain injury, whose brain and neural functioning are organized by the complex interplay between genes and experience, and therefore every single phenomenal aspect of his or her mind physically constrained, has any more free will than the neuroclinical case? After all, people have zero control over the particularly idiosyncratic brain they're born with, and very little control over their early life experiences, which in turn can only work with whatever congenital neural substrate is already there. Perhaps it's just a matter of timing. The good are born with brains that can go bad, whereas the bad are hogtied by a prospective morally disabled neural architecture from the very start. And although it may be less common, if a bad person behaves in an upstanding manner, could that be the result of fortuitous brain damage or epilepsy too? Should we not regard such a person highly if he saves a child from a burning building because, like the man gesturing to his 12-year-old stepdaughter to join him for sex, that isn't really him? It's not about holding healthy people to a higher standard or making excuses for criminals, but instead simply recognizing that the degree by which we have control over our actions, any of us, is entirely neurologically based. Free will is physical. And if indeed it's all brain-based in the end, a position you probably subscribed to at the start of this essay, this also includes the extent, the sophistication, and the parameters by which one can even objectively contemplate free will. Such thinking is constrained by brain-based cognitive capacities, after all. The shocking truth is that we're really only as free as our genes are pliable in the slosh of our developmental milieus. How the Brain Got Its Buttocks: Medieval Mischief in Neuroanatomy. There are so many specializations within the brain sciences that even the sharpest brain has scarcely enough brain power to learn everything there is to know about itself. But if there's one fact that the teacup Yorkie-sized prune in your head might want to ponder, it's that it shares a peculiar past with something considerably lower in your anatomy, your genitalia. I don't mean that our brains and reproductive organs share some embryological or evolutionary history, but rather that they were once, and to some extent they still are, entwined in the language of the body. What this odd story reveals is that the ancient anatomists were major dickheads. We all were back then. According to ancient nomenclature, even women had penises in their brains. Regis Olry, an anatomy professor, and Duane Haynes, a neurobiologist, brought the whole sordid tale to light in an intriguing pair of articles for the Journal of the History of the Neurosciences. These historians of neuroanatomy, yes, there is such a profession, and we should all be grateful for it, reviewed a very old, circuitous medical literature and found that the human brain was once described as comprising its very own vulva, penis, testicles, buttocks, and even anus. Not surprisingly, it was men doing all the classifying and labeling. In fact, part of the cerebrum is still named in honor of long-forgotten prostitutes, which I'll get to in a moment. In their first article over 10 years ago, Epics in Academic Terms, Olry and Haynes reveal the surprising origins of the term fornix. For those illiterate in neuroanatomy, the fornix is an arching band of nerve fibers that connects the hippocampus and the limbic system and spans certain fluid-filled chambers of the brain known as ventricles. You'd have numerous and noticeable problems if your fornix weren't functioning properly, including serious impairments in spatial learning and overall navigation. Some basics of etymology. Although today fornix is reserved almost exclusively for anatomical structures, there's also a fornix of the conjunctivae, which connects the membranes of the eye, as well as several other bodily fornices. But let's move on. The word originally held an architectural connotation, coming from the Latin for arch. Olry and Haynes point out that Roman architects during the 1st century BC created wooden rooms with vaulted ceilings called fornices. When such rooms were made of brick, they were called cameras. There's a separate etymological history involving the modern-day camera and these brick-arched Roman rooms, but we're focusing on the fornix here. Now, none of this is terribly salacious, and it's quite possible that the first neuroanatomist ever to use this term, the 17th century Englishman Thomas Willis, had nary a dirty thought in mind. But it's also a fact that the wood-vaulted rooms of old were used expressly for the plying of a particular trade in ancient Rome, prostitution, hence fornication. The real etymology of the term fornix, concluded Olry and Haynes, is therefore related to the form of the roof of the third ventricle, but also to the sexual intercourse which occurred in such rooms, these rooms being compared with this ventricle. It's merely an ironic twist that the fornix helps to regulate human sexual behavior as part of the limbic system. As the authors point out, the name was bestowed long before anyone knew this function. In any event, once they'd put the fornix to bed, Olry and Haynes waited another decade or so before they revisited the sexy third ventricle. In a follow-up article, they exposed some more rather curiously named features from the same part of the brain. When the mid-16th century Italian anatomist Matteo Rialdo Colombo peered into the small recess adjoining the anterior commissure and the dividing line of the fornix's two columns, report Olry and Haynes, he saw what looked like a lubricated vulva and called it the vulva cerebri. Perhaps that's not too surprising, given that Colombo is also widely credited as being the anatomist who first, quote, discovered the clitoris, the real one. The authors point out there's a bit of a mystery about precisely which hole Colombo was poking with his Italian probe. It might, in fact, have been the more posterior opening identified by the 17th century Dutch anatomist Isbrand van Diemerbroek. who found in Columbo's groove the whole of the anus. Your brain's anus, incidentally, is what we now call the common posterior opening of the midbrain's aqueduct, which fills into the third ventricle. There are so many defecation-related puns about intelligence to be made here that my mind is cramping up. So shit, I'll just leave that part up to you assholes. Now, van Diemerbroek didn't just see lady bits in the brain. If anything, he and his fellow anatomist envisioned it as an essentially hermaphroditic organ. After all, not only did it have a vulva cerebri, it also possessed a distinctive penis cerebri. René Descartes may have celebrated the pineal gland as the seat of the soul, but for the less metaphysically minded von Diemerbroek, as well as one of Descartes' contemporaries, the Danish physician Thomas Bartholin, that structure was more like a penis. This metaphor may have its roots, explained Orrin Haynes, in the position of the gland above and between the brain's colliculi, which had originally been compared with testicles, as perhaps the original hanging brain. This cockeyed term, penis cerebri, proved too embarrassing for future scholars and quickly shrank into disuse. Yesterday's penis is today's soulless pineal gland, a stiffer term to be sure. By the mid-18th century in France, a real buzzkill of an anatomist by the name of Jacques Benin Winslow was already looking back in disgust at his forebears' indelicate classifications. The ancients, he thought, had their heads in the gutter when it came to what was in their heads. Winslow held these founding fathers of the neurosciences in particular disrepute for their having seen buttocks and testicles in the colliculi. The names that were given to these tubercles, he says, are very impertinent and have no resemblance with the things they were derived from. Others beg to differ, however, and scholars continue to refer to the buttocks and testicles in our brains for centuries after Winslow huffed and puffed about the matter, even into the 20th century. Eventually, however, academic prudery eclipsed asinine antiquarianism. Still, a spunky remnant of those lost days of brainiac debauchery did slip into the present-day vocabulary. According to Orrin Haynes, the glandular portion of the pineal gland can be traced back to its bulbous terminological predecessor, the gland's penis. Today we know that the pineal gland produces melatonin, a chemical central to regulating your sleep-wake cycle. So the next time you have jet lag, blame it on your penis. And if I haven't nursed the history of the mammillary bodies, those small round bodies on the undersurface of the brain that are believed responsible for adding smell to recognition memory, that's only because it's too easy. Orrin and Haynes weren't the first to scratch their heads over this lurid labeling of neuroanatomical regions. Joining the prudish Winslow in his disdain, the French anatomist Joseph Fort observed in 1902 that the anatomists of past centuries enjoyed giving indecent names to the different parts surrounding the third ventricle. But Orrin Haynes revealed exactly how these medieval anatomists cast their libidinous eyes upon the gray matter and saw not the glistening engine of our thoughts, but also our private parts. Lascivious zombies. Sex, sleepwalking, nocturnal genitals, and you. It may seem to you that much like their barnyard animal namesake, men's reproductive organs the world over participate in a mindless synchrony of stiffened salutes to the rising sun. In fact, however, such morning wood is an autonomic leftover from a series of nocturnal penile tumescence episodes that occur like clockwork during the night for all healthy human males, most frequently in the dream-filled rapid eye movement periods of sleep, from which we're so often rudely awakened in the AM by buzzers, mothers, or others. For those with penises, you may be surprised to learn how frequently your member stands up while the rest of your body is rendered catatonic by the muscular paralysis that keeps you from acting out your dreams. And thank goodness for that. Carlos Schenck and his colleagues from the Minnesota Regional Sleep Disorder Center described the case of a 19-year-old with sleep-related dissociative disorder crawling around in his house on all fours, growling and chewing on a piece of bacon. He was dreaming, apparently, of being a jungle cat and pouncing on a slab of raw meat held by a female zookeeper. Scientists have determined that the average 13 to 79-year-old penis is erect for about 90 minutes each night, or 20% of overall sleep time. With your brain cycling between the four sleep stages, your sleep-related erections appear at 85-minute intervals, lasting on average 25 minutes. It's true, they used a stopwatch. As far as I'm aware, there aren't many well-developed evolutionary theories or a proposed adaptive function of nocturnal penile tumescence, but we do know that it's not related to daytime sexual activity. It declines, no pun intended, with age, and it's correlated positively with testosterone levels. Although far fewer studies have examined women's nocturnal genitals, females similarly exhibit vaginal lubrication during their REM sleep, presumably with many dreaming of erect penises. Now, you may not think that such tedious biological details would be fodder for a moral quandary, but you underestimate our species' massive confusion when it comes to understanding how its coveted free will articulates with its genitalia. Consider the case of a young Frenchman whose sleep-related erection was interpreted by another man as a sign of sexual interest, but swore the former was nothing of the kind. As described by a group of investigators at the annual meeting of the French Sleep Research Society in 2001, the 24-year-old heterosexual male awoke to his horror with painful anal lesions. Although being heavily intoxicated at the time, he had no conscious recollection of any such incident occurring, this led him to deduce that he must have been raped during the night. The legal medical examination indeed reported on visibly recent tears of the anal margin, confirmed the researchers. Then comes the sobering whodunit. Especially disquieting was that the man's boss had slept over the night before. The two had earlier been lounging in the pool and roasting together in the sauna. There was absolutely no evidence of date rape drugs, but alcohol, as it so often does in the south of France, flowed with relatively gay abandon that evening, and so the straight employee, being a gentleman, had invited his employer to sleep it off on his sofa while he retired to the mezzanine. Apparently, however, it was the employee who slept particularly hard that night, not the inebriated boss. The older man readily admitted that of course they'd had sex overnight, and he could only assume that his colleague's erection, combined with the fact that the other didn't resist as he mounted him, suggested that he was a consensual partner. You thought you were a deep sleeper, imagine the somnambulistic fortitude required to snooze through your first anal penetration. While the courts tried to sort it all out, the alleged rapist was imprisoned for 2 years until finally a judge decided that both men were more or less right and the accused should be set free. This is but one of many curious examples of sex and law intertwining. The related phenomenon of sexsomnia, or sleep sex, has witnessed periodic public interest through a spate of high-profile cases, stories that have in turn motivated intriguing academic research on this little-known subject. Even Alfred Kinsey, the grand archivist of Carnal Facts, while devoting much of his discussions to the subject of wet dreams and nocturnal emissions in both sexes, didn't mention how some people act out sexually during their sleep. Unlike the aforementioned case of the sleeping employee being the passive, immobilized recipient in unwanted intercourse, it's the sleeper who instigates the trouble in bouts of sexsomnia. Although researchers don't yet have an exact figure on the frequency of this parasomnia, most specialists believe that it's probably fairly common. Nearly all people who exhibit recurrent sexual acts while sleeping have a history of sleepwalking. In fact, many experts believe that sexsomnia is simply a variant of sleepwalking, which affects 1-2% of adults, and this is how it's presently classified in the main diagnostic manual, the International Classification of Sleep Disorders. Most people do not seek out clinical treatment due to either their ignorance of the condition or their embarrassment, and oftentimes their sexual automatisms are innocuous enough, such as fugue state masturbation, weak pelvic thrust, or steamy pillow talk. I'll say more on the concept of automatism in a moment. In a 2007 issue of Brain Research Reviews, however, the psychobiologist Monica Anderson and her co-authors investigated all case studies that had, at that point, been published in the literature, and they attempted to piece together some common denominators underlying sexsomnia. They found that the most common precipitating factors of sleep sex are sleep deprivation, stress, alcohol or drug consumption, excessive fatigue, and physical overactivity in the evening. Being male and under the age of 35 is also a major factor, they reported. Furthermore, when women do lapse into this altered nocturnal state, their actions tend to be comparatively innocuous, moaning and masturbating, rather than, like male sexsomniacs, fondling and grinding whatever is unfortunate enough to be in the vicinity of their bed that night. One of the most extraordinary things about sexsomnia is that the sleeping person's inappropriate behaviors are sometimes directed at people that, during their waking lives, are not particularly arousing to them. In a 1996 issue of Medicine, Science, and the Law, the psychiatrist Peter Fenwick describes the case of an allegedly heterosexual male cadet who was court-martialed for homosexual assault after he'd crawled into bed with another soldier and caressed that private's privates. The case was dismissed after the court accepted that the absence of an erection in the accused, sexsomnia may or may not involve erections, meant it was unlikely that the episode was purposeful, but instead just a bizarre sleepwalking incident. Another example of atypical homosexuality and sexsomnia involved a 16-year-old who walked into his aunt and uncle's bedroom one night and began molesting his adult uncle. Erections, as I hinted at earlier, complicate matters for the judicial system. One notorious case garnering international media attention, and as reviewed in Current Psychiatry by a group of sleep researchers from the Cleveland Clinic, centered on a 30-year-old landscaper named Jean Ludek, who drank far too much at a wild croquet party in the Toronto suburbs one night back in 2003 and fell asleep on a couch. Sometime later, explained the authors, he approached a woman who was sleeping on an adjacent couch, put on a condom, and began sexual intercourse with her. From her terrified perspective, the woman awoke to discover that her underwear had been removed and a glassy-eyed Ludek was trying to rape her. She pushed him off, ran to the washroom, and returned to find him standing there bewildered. Ludek, who had an established history of sleepwalking behaviors, was acquitted after the psychiatrist Colin Shapiro testified for the defense that the accused was in a dissociative state when the incident occurred, and therefore he was not consciously aware of his actions. Difficult legal cases such as these hinge entirely on the demonstrability, or at least strong probability, of an automatism, a crime committed during sleep. This is a concept for which Fenwick provided one of the clearest definitions. He says, an automatism is an involuntary piece of behavior over which an individual has no control. The behavior is usually inappropriate to the circumstances and may be out of character for the individual. It can be complex, he says, coordinated and apparently purposeful and directed, though lacking in judgment. Afterwards, the individual may have no recollection or only a partial and confused memory for his actions. In other words, sexomniacs are basically lascivious zombies. There's presently no way to determine with absolute certainty if the phenomenon, when invoked as a defense, was really the cause or just a convenient alibi. Still, certain criteria, detailed sleep pattern data from a nocturnal polysomnography, or sleepwalking and sleep-related sex in the past, known trigger factors such as intoxication, fatigue, and stress, timeline of the alleged assault, since episodes typically occur within 2 hours of sleep onset during non-REM sleep, amnesia for the event, no attempt to conceal or cover up the incident, but instead confusion, can at least aid a jury in its decision-making. It's tempting, to say the least, to be skeptical that a sleepwalker could act so purposefully as to fiddle successfully with a condom wrapper, yet be as conscious as an orthopteron. But the London sleep researcher Irshad Ibrahim reminds us that sleepwalking behaviors are highly variable and can be very detail-oriented, citing people preparing meals and eating, driving motorbikes and cars, even riding horses, all while getting a good night's sleep. For those for whom sexomnia has become a serious problem, in a legalistic sense or otherwise, the good news is that it responds well to pharmaceutical intervention. Just a small dose of benzodiazepines, most notably clonazepam, before bedtime seems to do the trick for most. You might want to consider discussing this with your doctor if you've shown a history of sexual violence during sleep, or say, you're a frequent sleepwalker and there are children in the home. Several cases have, in fact, involved very unsettling child abuse charges being filed against alleged sexomniacs. But sexomnia can be a problem even for those who live and sleep alone. After 5 years of waking up several nights a week with ejaculate mysteriously between his fingers, one 27-year-old was distressed to realize that he was a somnambulistic masturbator. The poor man broke 2 fingers when his nocturnal alter ego tore off the restraints he'd used to avoid moving in bed. There are also those, I should point out, whose sex lives have actually benefited courtesy of their partner's sexomnia. Shank and his co-authors review several such cases, including a woman who, quote, reported infrequent and hurried sex with her awake husband, whom she described as distant and reluctant during wakefulness. This lady found that, with him at least, nocturnal sex was more satisfactory, even if associated with bruises at times. So in closing, how do you determine if your partner's overnight poking is thoughtless or thoughtful? I'll spare you the details, but this is the very question that prompted me several nights ago to write this essay. Apparently, snoring during sexual behavior is a good sign and something that the partners of many sexomniacs mention as occurring, quite out of the blue, during even the most complicated sex acts. It occurred to me also that zombified nocturnal penile tumescence episodes may be distinguished from actual conscious sexual arousal by the presence or absence of, what to call it, penile flicking. That's not a technical term, but since I dredged the depths of the literature in vain trying to find the proper term for this voluntary lateral up and down movement of the erect penis through the clenching of the pubococcygeus muscle. Oh, come on, don't pretend you don't know what I'm talking about. Please permit me a little poetic license. I always thought such penile flicking responses must serve some communicative signaling function in our species, but apparently nobody has thought to study them from an adaptive perspective. Imagine that. Anyway, could a sexomniac use his social cognition to deliberately communicate a message of sexual interest by flicking his penis at his partner? It's probably not a fail-safe clue, but I suspect not. And bear that helpful hint in mind for whenever the apocalypse arrives, since God only knows it will come with its share of sex-crazed male zombies, a lot of Randy Gay ones too, according to many Christian conservatives. Humans are special and unique. We masturbate. A lot. There must be something in the water in Lanesboro, Minnesota, because the night I stayed over there, en route to a conference, I dreamed of an encounter with a very muscular African-American centaur, an orgiastic experience with drunken members of the opposite sex, and, as if that weren't enough, then being asked by my hostess to don a white wedding dress for my upcoming keynote presentation. Does it make me look too feminine? Not at all, she assured me. It's a man's dress. Now, Freud might raise his eyebrows at such a lurid dreamscape, but if these images represent my repressed sexual yearnings, then there's a side of me that I apparently have yet to discover. But I doubt that this is the case. Dreams with erotic undertones are like most other dreams during REM sleep, runaway trains with a conductor who is helpless to do anything about the surrealistic directions they take. Rather, if you really want to know about a person's hidden sexual desires, then find out what's on his mind's eye during the deepest throes of masturbation. This conjuring ability to create fantasy scenes in our heads that literally bring us to orgasm when conveniently paired with our dexterous appendages is an evolutionary magic trick. It requires a cognitive capacity called mental representation, an internal representation of a previously experienced image or some other sensory input, that many evolutionary theorists believe is a relatively recent hominid innovation. When it comes to sex, we put this capacity to very good, or at least very frequent, use. In a classic pre-internet porn study, I'll get to internet porn in a moment, by the evolutionary biologists Robin Baker and Mark Bellis, male university students were found to masturbate to ejaculation about every 72 hours. And, they write, on the majority of occasions, their last masturbation is within 48 hours of their next in-pair copulation. If they're not having intercourse every day, that is to say, men tend to pleasure themselves to completion no more than 2 days after last having actual sex. Baker and Bellis's quite logical argument for the seemingly counterintuitive state of affairs, after all, shouldn't men try to stock up as much sperm as possible in their testes, rather than spill their seed so wastefully in a rather infertile swath of toilet paper or a sock, is that because there's a shelf life for sperm cells, they remain viable for only 5 to 7 days after production, and because adult human males manufacture a whopping 3 million sperm per day, masturbation is an evolved strategy for shedding old sperm while making room for new, fitter sperm. It's quality over quantity. Here are the adaptive logistics, according to the scientists. They write, the advantage to the male could be that the younger sperm are more acceptable to the female and or better able to reach a secure position in the female tract. Moreover, once retained in the female tract, younger sperm could be more fertile in the absence of sperm competition, sexually monogamous relationships, and or more competitive in the presence of sperm competition in which the woman is having sex with other men. Finally, they say, if younger sperm live longer in the female tract, any enhanced fertility and competitiveness would also last longer. Unconvinced? Well, Baker and Bellis are intelligent empiricists. They also have stomachs of steel. One way that they tested their hypotheses was to ask over 30 brave heterosexual couples to provide them with some rather concrete samples of their sex lives, the vaginal flowbacks from their post-coital couplings, in which some portion of the male's ejaculate is spontaneously rejected by the woman's body. As Baker and Bellis explain, the flowback emerges 5 to 120 minutes after copulation as a relatively discrete event over a period of 1 to 2 minutes in the form of 3 to 8 white globules. With practice, they say, females can recognize the sensation of the beginning of flowback and can collect the material by squatting over a 250-milliliter glass beaker. And here comes the useful tip, ladies. Once the flowback is nearly ready to emerge, it can be hastened by, for example, coughing. As the authors predicted, the number of sperm in the girlfriend's flowbacks increased significantly the longer it had been since the boyfriend's last masturbation, even after the researchers controlled for the relative volume of seminal fluid emission as a function of time since last ejaculation. The longer it had been, the more ejaculate, on average, was present. If only the parents of teenage boys had these findings available for the first 100,000 years of our history, think of all the anxiety, guilt, and shame that might never have been. In fact, even G. Stanley Hall, the father of adolescent psychology research, had a particularly nasty thorn in his paw when it came to the subject of masturbation. Hall accepted that spontaneous nocturnal emissions, that is, wet dreams, in adolescent boys were natural, but he viewed masturbation as a scourge of the human race, destructive of that perhaps most important thing in the world, the potency of good heredity. In Hall's view, the offspring of teenage masturbators would show signs of what he called persistent infantilism or overripeness. Boys will be boys, Dr. Hall, and though there's lamentably no data on this, I'd still bet that those teenagers who deny themselves this natural behavior tend to have more issues than those who don't. Now back to masturbation fantasies and cognition, and this is where it gets really interesting. Baker and Bellis's theory may be peculiarly true for human beings, because from all appearances, under natural conditions, we are the only primate species that seems to have taken these seminal shedding benefits into its own hands. Unfortunately, there have been a paltry number of studies tracking the masturbatory behaviors of non-human primates. Although some relevant data is probably buried in some mountain of field notes, I didn't come across any targeted studies on the subject in wild chimpanzees, and even the prolific Jane Goodall doesn't seem to have gone there. Nevertheless, by all available accounts, and by contrast with human beings, masturbation to completion is an exceedingly rare phenomenon in other species with capable hands very much like our own. As anybody who has ever been to the zoo knows, there's no question that other primates play with their genitalia. Bonobos are notorious for this. The point is that these diddling episodes so seldom lead to an intentional orgasm. There's not much out there in the way of proper research on ape masturbation, but some studies here and there do seem to document the infrequency of masturbation in other primates. In the early 1980s, scientists observed the sexual behaviors of several groups of wild gray-cheeked mangabeys for over 22 months in the Kibali forest of western Uganda. There was plenty of sex, particularly during the female's peak swellings, but the researchers only came across two incidents of male masturbation leading to ejaculation. Yes, that's right. Whereas healthy human males can't seem to go without masturbating for longer than 72 hours, two measly cases of masturbating mangabeys were observed over a nearly two-year period. The anthropologist E.D. Sterin didn't have much luck spying incidents of masturbation in red colobus monkeys in Gambia either. In a brief 2004 article published in Folia Primatologica, Sterin reports that over a 5.5-year period of accumulated observations totaling more than 9,500 hours, she saw only five incidents of her population of five male colobus monkeys masturbating to ejaculation. And these rare incidents occurred only when nearby sexually receptive females were exhibiting loud courtship displays and copulations with other males. Intriguingly, Sterin says that although females weren't in the immediate vicinity, it is possible that they could still be seen or heard by the masturbating male while the incident at hand occurred. In other words, no mental representation required. In fact, the author's descriptions of these events strike me as producing accidental rather than deliberate ejaculations. Not that they weren't happy accidents, but still. During each observation, Sterin writes, the male sat and rubbed, stretched, and scratched his penis until it became erect, after which additional rubbing produced ejaculate. Also, out of the 14 female colobus monkeys tracked during this time span, Sterin writes that three different females were observed possibly masturbating by self-stimulating their genitals, only possibly because none of these episodes culminated in the telltale signs of colobus orgasm, muscle contractions or facial expressions, or wild screams of merciless bliss. Perhaps the most colorful report of non-human primate masturbation, or rather the astonishing lack thereof, even in subordinate males that aren't getting any, comes from a 1914 Journal of Animal Behavior study by a peculiar character named Gilbert Van Tassel Hamilton. Hamilton apparently ran something of a monkey research center coom sanctuary on the lush grounds of his Montecito, California estate. He was also clearly a pioneering sexologist, or at least had especially liberal attitudes for his time, defending the naturalness of homosexual behavior in the animal kingdom, among other things. In justifying his research, which meant getting up close and personal with his monkey's genitals, Hamilton opines, "The possibility that the types of sexual behavior to which the term perverted is usually applied may be of normal manifestation and biologically appropriate somewhere in the phyletic scale has not been sufficiently explored." In fact, he seems to have expected to find rampant masturbation in his animals, but to his surprise, only one male named Jocko ever partook in such manual pleasures. "Of all my male monkeys," wrote Hamilton, "only Jocko has been observed to masturbate. After a few days' confinement, he would masturbate and eat part of his semen. I have reason to believe that he lived under unnatural conditions for many years before I acquired him." In view of this fact that not one of seven sexually mature monkeys masturbated after several weeks of isolation under conditions that favored a fairly healthy mental and physical life, close proximity to other monkeys, large cages, warm climate, I am inclined to believe that masturbation is not of normal occurrence among monkeys. Granted, Hamilton seems to have been just a tad eccentric. Earlier in the article, he reports that one of his female monkeys named Maud liked to be mounted and entered by a pet male dog out in the yard until one day poor horny old Maud offered her backside to a strange mongrel that proceeded to bite off her arm. More disturbing is Hamilton's description of a monkey named Jimmy, who one sunny afternoon discovered a human infant lying in a hammock. Jimmy promptly endeavored to copulate with the infant, observes Hamilton matter-of-factly. It's unclear whether or not this was the author's own child, nor is there any mention of the look on said human infant's mother's face when she saw what Jimmy was getting up to. In any event, though he may have had some questionable child supervision skills, the candor with which Hamilton reports on the sex lives of his monkeys lends his tales that much more credence. So why don't monkeys and apes masturbate nearly as much as humans? It's a rarity even among low-status male non-human primates that frustratingly lack sexual access to females. In fact, the few observed incidents seem to be with dominant males. And why haven't more researchers noticed such an obvious difference with potentially enormous significance for understanding the evolution of human sexuality? After all, it's been nearly 60 years since Alfred Kinsey first reported that 92% of Americans were involved in masturbation leading to orgasm. The explanation for this cross-species difference, I'm convinced, lies in our uniquely evolved mental representational abilities. We alone have the power to conjure up at will erotic, orgasm-inducing scenes in the personal movie theaters of our minds. Internal salacious fantasies completely disconnected from our immediate external realities. One early sex researcher, Wilhelm Steckel, described masturbation fantasies as a kind of trance or altered state of consciousness, writing, "a sort of intoxication or ecstasy, during which the current moment disappears and the forbidden fantasy alone reigns supreme." Go on, pause this program, take a 5-minute break, and put my challenge to the test. You may want to take leave for the restroom if you're listening to this on an airplane. Try to masturbate successfully, that is, to orgasmic completion, without casting some erotic representational target in your mind's eye. Instead, clear your mind entirely or think of, I don't know, an enormous blank canvas hanging in an art gallery. And of course, no porn or helpful naked assistants are permitted for this task either. How'd it go? If you're like most, you've seen the impossibility of it. This is one of the reasons, incidentally, why I find it so hard to believe that self-proclaimed asexuals who admit to masturbating to orgasm are really and truly asexual. They must be picturing something, and whatever that something is gives away their sexuality. Empirically capturing the phenomenology of masturbation fantasies is no easy matter. But some intrepid scholars have indeed tried to do so. In 1960, a British physician named Narcisse Lukinovich, in an issue of the Archives of General Psychiatry, published one of the most sensationalistic scientific reports I've ever had the pleasure of reading. Lukinovich personally interviewed 188 people, 126 males and 62 females, about their masturbation fantasies. An important caveat, all of these people were psychiatric patients with various complaints and different neurotic manifestations, so their masturbation fantasies aren't necessarily typical. Nevertheless, the details provided by these patients about their erotic fantasies gives us an extraordinary glimpse into the rich internal imagery accompanying human masturbation. Consider the self-report of a retired civil servant, age 71, being treated for obsessive feelings of guilt on account of his, quote, excessive masturbation. "I see in front of me naked, beautiful women dancing and performing some most exciting and tempting movements. After the dance, they lean back and, keeping their legs wide apart, show their genitals and invite me to have sexual intercourse with them. They appear so real that I can almost touch them. They're in a setting of an oriental harem in a large oval room with divans and a lot of cushions around the walls. I can clearly see the wonderful, gorgeous colors and the beautiful patterns of the tapestry with an unusual vividness and with all the minute details." Or consider Lukinovich's account of a 44-year-old schoolmaster's fantasies, which reads like some bacchanalia and morphine-dappled scene ripped from the pages of William Burroughs' Naked Lunch. Lukinovich writes, "In them he saw naked adolescent boys with their peens stiffly erected, parading in front of him. As he progressed in his masturbation, the peens of the boys increased in size, till finally the whole field of his vision was filled with one huge, erect, pulsating penis. And then the patient would have a prolonged orgasm. This type of homosexual masturbatory fantasy started shortly after his first homosexual experience, which he had at the age of 10, and it persists unchanged hitherto." Now, obviously, there are pathological cases of chronic masturbation where it actually interferes with the individual's functioning. In fact, it's not an uncommon problem for many caretakers of adolescents and adults with mental impairments, whose charges often enjoy masturbating in public and making onlookers squeal and squirm in discomfort. Not unlike some captive primates housed in miserable conditions such as laboratories or roadside zoos, where self-stimulation sometimes becomes obsessive. One thing that clinicians dealing with this problem may wish to consider is that the individual's cognitive limitations may not allow him to engage in more, quote, appropriate private masturbation because of difficulties with mental representation. In fact, frequency of erotic fantasies correlates positively with intelligence. The average IQ of Lukinovich's sample was 132. So perhaps public masturbation, in which other people are physically present to induce arousal, is the only way that many with developmental disorders can achieve sexual satisfaction. Sadly, of course, society isn't very accommodating of this particular problem. Between 1969 and 1989, for example, a single institution in the United States performed 656 castrations with the aim to stop the men from masturbating. One clinical study reported some success in eliminating this problem behavior by squirting lemon juice into the mouth of a young patient every time he pulled out his penis in public. In any event, Lukinovich argues that erotic fantasies involve imaginary companions not altogether unlike children's make-believe friends. But unlike the more long-lived latter, he concedes, the former is conjured up for one very practical purpose, he writes. As soon as the orgasm is achieved, the role of the imaginary sexual partner is completed, and he is quite simply and quickly dismissed from his master's mind. According to most findings in this area, men seem to entertain more visitors in their heads than do women. In a 1990 study published in the Journal of Sex Research, the evolutionary psychologists Bruce Ellis and Donald Simons found that 32% of men said that they'd had sexual encounters in their imagination with more than 1,000 different people, compared with only 8% of women. Men also reported rotating in from their imaginary rosters one imagined partner for another during the course of a single fantasy more often than women did. The psychologist Harold Leitenberg and Chris Henning summarized a number of interesting differences between the sexes in this area. In their review of research findings, the authors concluded that in general, a higher percentage of men reported fantasizing during masturbation than did women. It's important to point out, however, that neither fantasy nor masturbation was consistently defined across the studies summarized by Leitenberg and Henning, and some participants likely interpreted masturbation to mean simply self-stimulation, rather than orgasm-inducing, or had a more elaborate conceptualization of fantasy than we've been using here, as some form of basic mental representation. For uncertain reasons, one dubious study compared blacks and whites.